Now let's see if we can squeeze that a bit. Last transport just lifted off. I'll get us to the next rendezvous as soon as it's in the central corridor. Will nodded and popped out. 66. Battle continues. Bill, April 2257, Seoul. I turned as Will popped back in. How's it going in the Bellerophon? He gave me a sickly smile. You wouldn't want to be in the cargo bays with the humans. Neil and Herschel are taking care of it as best they can. Imagine roamers running around with vacuum cleaners in their claws. The unexpected image made me smile, but the levity only lasted a moment. Constant updates from the battle brought me back to reality. We're being slowly pushed back, Will, and I think they've detected the Bellerophon. It looks like they're trying to maneuver some death asteroids to get a clear shot at Earth. At Earth? Or at the Bellerophon? Good question. I guess I don't actually know. Although I can't see them figuring out what we're doing from this distance. Well, either way, let's see if we can keep them busy. Matching actions to words, Will marched over to the status displays. He pointed to the deployment graphic. They don't care about zapping us, of course, but they need to have a clear shot with none of their own forces in the way. That means no others defenders between the death asteroid and Earth. How can we exploit that? Kill them a lot? Will smirked at me. Can you be more specific? I thought for a moment. We haven't been making any use of inert railgun ammo. Let's unload a continuous salvo at the Death Stars that are exposed. That will have zero effect, Bill. They're too big. And they'll know that, and they'll dismiss the attack. And about 5 seconds in, we start interspersing ballistic nukes with the cannonballs. That will have an effect. Will grinned and turned to issue orders. For a wonder, it worked. 6 Death Stars went up in nuclear fireballs before the others decided to take the attack seriously. They split their attention between irradiating the Earth and irradiating our forces. Kind of a good news, bad news thing.
They just got off a zap at Earth or the Bellerophon, one of the monitoring Bobs announced.
Thor, I think, although I was having trouble keeping track by this point.
Can you get a good estimate of the target coordinates?
Silence for a moment, then.
Yes.
Inform the Bellerophon of any outgoing zaps in their direction. They might be able to react.
10-4. Whoops, 2 more zaps. This is heating up.
I turned to Will. We're not keeping them busy enough. If they zap the Bellerophon, this is all for nothing. Will thought for a moment, then gave orders.
Turn all our lasers, particle weapons, and spikes, every last one, on this group of death asteroids. Aim for the grids to the extent that you can, and keep up with the cannonballs and nukes.
That's going to weaken our overall defense, Will.
I know, Bill. He shrugged. But if we lose the Bellerophon, like you said, none of the rest of it really matters.
Bobs shifted their focus immediately. The area around the death asteroids began to look like a Star Wars battle scene, at least on the displays. At the distances we were working with, and in vacuum, the reality was less visually dramatic. We weren't able to completely stop the death asteroids. They got off several more zaps, and Thor faithfully reported the coordinates to the Bellerophon. But we were definitely bothering them, and a couple of the zaps went extremely wide, to the point that we considered scanning for something we might have missed. Then, success. 2 nukes managed to float in close enough at almost the same time. Twin explosions saturated the cameras for several seconds. When the view cleared, the last of the death asteroids attempting to zap the Earth were gone. A cheer went up from all the Bobs present. Will grinned at me.
It's not victory yet, of course, but at least we can turn our resources back to the main push. How's that going, by the way?
We're still being pushed back, Will. I shook my head. And we're running out of options.
Will came over to look at the status monitors. Crap. Well, maybe we can get back on top of it now. I'll go check with the other groups, if you're good here for now.
I nodded, but I wasn't hopeful. We might once again be depending on a Hail Mary play, which, by the way, hadn't worked out last time in Delta Pavonis.
67. Running. Herschel, April 2257, Seoul. We watched on the monitor as the last 3 transports flew past the main cargo doors into the corridor. The pilots were pushing it and would probably have some turbulence to deal with inside.
Neil started closing the doors before the transports had even cleared the entrance. I waited until they were sealed, then punched it as hard as I dared. The Bellerophon rose majestically through the atmosphere. Air turbulence was barely detectable and dropped off quickly. As soon as we were above atmosphere, I maneuvered to put the Earth between us and the battle. Then I gave it every ounce of juice available. We shot up into a powered orbit at almost 3G.
Sap coming your way, one of the death asteroids unloaded. 30 seconds, coordinates follow.
I examined the incoming data and did a right-angle turn. At this range, the Zap would be fairly narrow, and I should be able to get outside its cone of effect with little effort. I was more concerned with the number of death asteroids that might still be able to send Zaps our way. If they bracketed me, we'd be done.
Two more Zaps.
This set comprised a coordinated attack. The first was easy to dodge, as it was slightly behind me. But the obvious move would place me right square in the middle of the second one. Not a bad strategy at all, I admitted to myself. Except that with Scutcoms, I knew what was coming. I dodged in a random direction and smiled to myself as I imagined the others' gunnery crew grinding their teeth equivalents in frustration. Then I lost the smile as I realized that I'd just confirmed for the others that we had FTL communications. I fired off a quick text to Bill pointing that out. I didn't know if the others might be able to come up with a strategy based on that datum, but best to have it out in the open.
Another Zap, I think this one will graze the Earth.
Oh, not good. Neil, on it? Neil frantically ran calculations. Then he turned to me, fear written all over his face.
Hirsch, this one's going to hit.
The Earth?
Cuba.
Cuba? But they're...
Neil nodded.
Still there. We aren't scheduled to pick them up for another hour.
How long?
28 seconds now.
I stared at Neil for a couple of milliseconds. 150,000 people currently made Cuba their home. There was no chance to do anything at all. Not in that amount of time.
So they're
as good as dead.
I didn't know anyone there, of course. I'd only been in the system for a day or so, but Riker, that is, Will, would. I hoped he hadn't done the calculations. 30 seconds was an eternity to us. 30 seconds of thinking about people you know, now alive but soon dead. Neil was looking down at his board, his eyes squeezed shut.
I'll tell him, buddy. Afterward.
Neil looked up at me and nodded. He swallowed several times and got back to work. The silence hung heavy in the room for the rest of the minute. We sent a couple of drones to Cuba, more to cover all the possibilities than out of any real hope. It took about 2 seconds before we had to turn off the monitors. The inhabitants had gathered into several open areas for easier loading. So many bodies. The remainder of the loading went without incident. The others zapped at us several more times, but never came close. They had no way of knowing, of course, that they would have better results zapping the Earth directly. Or maybe they were offended at our use of their cargo vessel. Didn't really matter. Finally, we lifted away from the planet for the final time. I aimed the bow into a vector that would keep us in the Earth's shadow relative to the others and poured it on. It took several more hours of running before I was far enough away from the engagement to feel safe. From here, a zap wouldn't do more than create a pretty aurora around the mover plates. The battle continued to rage. It had turned into a war of attrition. The ultimate winner would probably be last man standing.
What are our chances?
Neil said. I had no better idea than he did, of course. He just wanted to talk. I gave him a shrug. If they win here, we'll have to head for one of the other colony worlds, which means setting up some kind of living arrangements in the cargo bays for 6 million people, while we build stasis pods en route. We could conceivably lose 1 million to starvation and disease. If we win, we can go back, unload, and build the rest of the stasis pods we need, then take everyone to 82 Eridani. But, I glared at Neil, we still have to deal with the others at their source. Otherwise, they can just regroup, rebuild, repopulate, and come back at us again, somewhere down the road. We sat staring into space for some indefinite amount of time. I checked the status of the humans occasionally. Moans, whimpers, and hopeless sobbing sounded from the monitors. As hard as this was for us, it was infinitely worse for them. They'd been living under a potential death sentence all their lives, but it had been a diffuse, indeterminate, and impersonal kind of threat. Now, the threat loomed over them, personal and immediate, potentially to be carried out at any moment. I picked up a video feed from a random roamer. People had generally managed to wedge themselves into the netting that we'd provided. It probably gave some feeling of up and down in the weightless environment. The refugees nearest to the camera all had their eyes closed, huddled, some with their arms wrapped around each other. They seemed to be trying to merely endure. In some unknown time, they'd either be offloaded or they'd be suddenly dead, not much to look forward to. I shook myself, disturbed by the morose thoughts. I had a job to do, and it mostly consisted of making sure the latter alternative didn't come to pass. At least the number of sanitation incidents had dropped off, although I was sure the air in the cargo bays must be ripe as hell. Then, a text from Will. It's over. 68. The Battle. Riker, April 2257, Seoul. I popped back into the command center to find a scene not unlike an ant's nest that had been stirred with a stick. Bobs yelled back and forth in a tone just barely short of panic. Several groups stood in front of display walls, arguing and gesturing aggressively. I found Bill quickly. What happened? Bill closed his eyes for a moment, a gesture of weariness and despair.
They pulled a fast one. The second super pulse must have hidden a quick sortie by a couple of squads of drones and missiles. We got blindsided. We're having to drop back and regroup.
A sudden thought made me check my reminders. Bill, we're coming up on the Joker's squad arrival. Will they be able to adjust course, or are we going to miss cleanly?
Shit!
Bill looked down and rubbed his forehead. Give me a moment. Bill's avatar froze. I took a moment to be mildly scandalized. Bill very rarely let himself go off character like that. Then I smiled to myself in a bemused way. If ever there was an excuse, this was certainly it. Bill came back to life, and his expression was slightly more hopeful.
It's kind of a good news, bad news thing. The good news is the Jokers can still make interception. The bad news is the others have launched their own countermeasures, more than enough to stop anything the Jokers can throw at them.
Have they overcommitted? Does that leave them open at our end?
No.
Bill shook his head. They have too much ordnance. Both we and the Jokers are outmatched. So there's no reasonable hope for a strategic win.
No, Will.
Bill sat down, tired and defeated. Then it's time for an act of desperation, isn't it? Bill chuckled.
Thanks, Mr. Spock. Well, why not? Maybe we can force them to recall some of what they've thrown at the Jokers.
I nodded. We had a large complement of AMI-controlled dreadnoughts that wouldn't hesitate to sacrifice themselves. Gotta love AMIs. But we'd been holding them back in case an opportunity opened up. We'd be essentially throwing almost all of our fuel on the fire at once. Like there was a choice. I gave the orders and almost 100 dreadnoughts and assorted heaven vessels threw themselves forward at full acceleration. All other vessels were ordered to get out of line of fire. We could be pretty sure that the others would be using the zappers. The others reacted immediately, spewing another cloud of defenders from a cargo vessel and rotating their death asteroids to bear on the oncoming vessels. They've made a mistake, Thor said, bemused. We all looked at him. He turned and grinned at us. Right idea, wrong vessel. They launched defenders from a cargo vessel that's just a little too far from the action. Even with their acceleration, they won't get there on time. Sure enough, the others seemed to realize their mistake as another cargo vessel opened its doors and disgorged all its fighter units. Too late, though. They'd get there even later, thanks to the delay. I smiled to myself as I visualized some other's general somewhere in the armada screaming at his subordinates and waving his whatevers in fury. It helped. A bit. A couple of dreadnoughts had pulled ahead deliberately. Now they detonated all their cargo at once. The resulting explosions cleared most of the first wave of enemy defenders, allowing the following dreadnoughts a clear path. They flew in, positioned for maximum spread and maximum effect. Then all detonated at once.
We hadn't built high megatonnage nukes. We had built for tactical strikes, not destruction of entire cities. Still, that many vessels, each with multiple warheads, made for an impressive fireball. The theater didn't clear for almost half a minute. We cheered as we finally got a look at the results. Just over a third of the other's fleet was still in operation, and now they were forced to regroup, slowing their advance and attempting to reposition so as not to leave defensive holes. Our guess was they would make increasing use of zaps now. Better to take us down than be able to recharge at their leisure before attacking Earth. Of course, that would have been the best strategy in the first place, but the others had long since proven they were beyond arrogant. They simply didn't expect us to mount anything like the same level. I stared into space, my jaw dropping. Bill noticed and turned to me, a frown on his face. You okay, Will? I cocked my head at him. Bill, the Jokers are up near light speed, right? Well, yeah, we wanted them coming in as fast as possible. Not that it'll do any good now. The others can still knock the nukes out of the sky before they get close enough. I let a slow grin spread across my face. But we don't have to get close enough. We know from scans that the Death Asteroids aren't particularly shielded against zappers. Well, no, they're more into handing it out. So, at the speed the Jokers are going, radiation from a blast is going to Doppler way up, way, way up. Actually up higher than what the others are using, I think. Now Bill's eyes opened wide. He spun to face the status board and spoke rapidly into the Joker's channel. Hannibal, launch all your nukes right now, straight at the others, and detonate every one of them at the earliest safe moment. Make sure you spray every other's vessel. Try not to hit us, but if you have to make a choice, we'll take the sacrifice. Confirm. Got it, Bill. Launching now. The board showed the Jokers emit a shower of smaller units, close to 1,000 bombs, originally intended to detonate in the middle of the other's fleet. If this didn't work, we'd have wasted most of our remaining ordnance. Bill looked at me, seeming to read my mind. He said, they'd have all gone to waste anyway, Will. It was tight. We'd acted just this side of too late. Perhaps 2 seconds short of engagement with the oncoming other's defenders, every single nuke detonated, and 5 seconds later, the radiation reached the other's fleet. The Doppler effect from the velocity of the ordnance pushed the radiation frequency from the explosions above even what the Death Asteroids could produce. We were, in effect, giving them a large taste of their own medicine. Any vessel in the path of that radiation, even if it wasn't physically damaged, would be sterilized of all life. And there was a good chance that any electronics would be fried as well. The cone of destruction was wide, wide enough to bathe about 50 of our dreadnoughts as well as the others' fleet. We watched their status lights flare red and go out on the board. All action in the battlefield ceased, as if everyone were holding their breath. We waited. Milliseconds passed, then entire seconds, with no reaction. We've won, I think. Bill goggled at the screen, frank disbelief written on his face. It's over.
Screw that, Thor exclaimed. I'm nuking them anyway. Who's still got munitions?
A series of responses came back. Too few for comfort. At that moment, we began to truly realize just how close we'd come to losing. There was a moment of mutual staring, then Bill nodded and said, Fire at will. Finish it off. I sat down heavily. Looks like the humans will survive after all.
Oh, right, Bill slapped his forehead. Herschel and Neil are still running like hell. I guess we should let them know.
He grinned at me and I motioned him to go ahead. But first, I sent them a quick text. It's over.
69. Ending. Bob. May 2233. Delta Eridani. I set the water skin down and tied the pergola walls open. Outside, another gorgeous day on Eden was dawning. Bird-like things sang and squirrel-like things chewed out anyone and everyone for the crime of existing. I picked up the skin and went over to sit by Archimedes. Wake up, buddy,
I brought fresh water. He hadn't woken up yet. I tried to let Archimedes sleep as long as possible to keep up his strength. I reached over to nudge him, and nothing. No breathing sounds, no pulse. I could hear a low whining sound. It took me a second to realize it was coming from me. A hand on my shoulder. Belinda.
Robert. Robert. You have to move.
I looked up to see Buster gazing down at me, sadness on his face. I realized I was in the way. I got up, walked stiff-legged to the other end of the tent, lay down, and curled into a ball. The funeral for Archimedes was huge. It was not just his family. Almost every living Deltan had been affected by him one way or another. By the time the procession was over, Archimedes was covered in white flowers. When the family moved in to fill in the grave, I asked them if I could have some time. Everyone looked at Buster, who nodded. Archimedes and I had been inseparable for 20 Earth years, about 18 years on Eden. It was a reasonable request. As soon as the others had moved far enough away, I directed one of the small baseball-sized drones into the grave. With the camouflage systems working overtime, it was almost completely invisible as it snuck along the ground and in. I reached over, moved Archimedes' arm slightly, and settled the drone into his embrace. Spy drones didn't show anyone having noticed anything. I admitted to myself that it was a silly, meaningless act, but it felt somehow right. I wanted to leave a piece of me with him. After an appropriate amount of time, I got up and walked over to Buster and the rest of the family. They turned to me. Then, wordlessly, we proceeded to fill in the grave and cover it with stone slabs. The drone, with the new Casimir power supply, would probably last centuries. Something would give out eventually, of course, but meanwhile, anything or anyone that disturbed the grave would get a face full of surprise. When we were done, I knelt at his grave for a while longer. Afterward, I went to his tent, where Belinda and Buster were sitting. Belinda offered me some jerky, and we ate silently. When we were done, Buster said,
"You can have his things, if you want. You've been his best friend for years."
I responded with a brief smile about all I could manage. "Thanks, Buster. But I think I'll be going. Archimedes was all that was holding me here." Buster gazed at me in a perplexed silence for a few moments. Then he said, diffidently,
"Robert, you're the Bob, aren't you?"
"Yes, Buster, I am." I shrugged. "And with Archimedes gone, well..."
"Will we be okay?"
I nodded. "Yes, you will. You've gotten control of your environment now. You'll show the world who's boss. And in some huge number of hands of years, your children's children's children will come find me and mine." I stood. "Goodbye, Buster, Belinda. Live long and prosper." And without looking back, I walked out of the village to the waiting cargo drone. 70. Extermination. Icarus. December 2256 to April 2257, approaching GL-877. Showtime. GL-877 was still several light months away, but at our Tau, Daedalus and I would experience it as minutes at most. Comms was receiving periodic queries and updates from local Bobs, probably Mario and his group, still trying to keep tabs on the others. Incoming messages were barely squeaks to me. The time dilation was far too severe for replicant hardware to overcome. Guppy was handling responses, but I'd asked him not to forward anything to me unless it was an emergency. I couldn't afford any distractions. I squirted off a differential backup, just in case. I wouldn't get another chance. I dismissed my VR and frame-jacked up to maximum. At this level, I could sense jitter in my perceptions as my hardware attempted to pixelate reality. As we reached the 5-light-day point, I ordered Guppy to broadcast a message directing all local Bobs to get out of Dodge. Anyone caught too close to GL-877 in a short while
would need a new paint job. We had planned our approach so that I would come in from Stellar North and Daedalus from Stellar South. At 6 light-hours distance, GL-877 was showing a perceptible disc without magnification. Continuous status updates between Day and myself ensured that we would arrive at the same instant. Everything was in the groove, and there wasn't anything the others could do at this point to divert this delivery. Time for a final check. It looks good, Day. I think we're close enough now. No way anything's going to fall out of sync. There was a pause, presumably Daedalus performing his own checks. Agreed, Icky. Time to save our own butts. You got it, buddy. I separated from my payload and accelerated as hard as I could toward Galactic Center. The rear camera showed the former planet of Epsilon Eridani shrinking in the distance as it continued on its appointed path. Readings showed Daedalus ejecting in the opposite direction from the other side of GL-877. We would each skim the star, closer at Periastron than the orbit of Mercury. GL-877 grew in size over a matter of seconds. I could see prominences and flares on the surface of the star, and Sudar picked up the huge mass concentrations of the Dyson sphere under construction. By now, the others would have detected the two planets, approaching it just a hair under light speed. Did they know? Did they understand in their final seconds what was upon them? I hoped so. The PAV had never had that opportunity, nor probably the species from Zeta Tucani, whose name we would never know. Slightly behind me, the planet formerly known as Epsilon Eridani 1, a planet the size of Mars, struck the star at the North Pole with a relativistic force equivalent to half the mass of Jupiter. At the same moment, the former largest moon of Epsilon Eridani 3 struck on the opposite pole. Stars are hot, but not really dense. The two planets penetrated to a significant depth before they ceased to exist. The impacts created twin shockwaves that raced through the star toward the core. As the disturbances penetrated deeper and compressed the stellar medium, regions that weren't quite able to sustain hydrogen fusion suddenly found the ability. Regions that were already sustaining fusion found their ability greatly increased. Elements that were nowhere near being able to fuse in the current environment suddenly found themselves with the energy available. Helium fused to carbon and oxygen, and fusion cascaded all the way to iron. In a matter of minutes, the total energy output of the star jumped by a factor of several hundred. The delicate balance of outward energy pressure and inward gravitational pressure was obliterated, and GL-877 exploded outward at half the speed of light. It would take 3 hours for the star to swallow the entire system. However, it took half that for the blast of radiation to sterilize everything. Fleeing the star at 99 point some stupid number of nines of the speed of light, Daedalus and I would see this blast as radio waves. But we'd have to stay at high tau for several light years before it would be safe to even think about decelerating. That's for the PAV. And for all the other unnamed species that you've seen fit to remove from existence.
71. Victory. Herschel, April 2257, Sol. We had to wait several more full seconds for follow-up. Bill and Will were apparently very busy bobs for the moment. Finally, Bill popped in, a huge grin on his face. And a patch over his eye, his arm in a sling, and several band-aids done in typical cartoon cross patterns on his body. Neil burst into gales of laughter and fell off his chair. I just managed to keep a straight face, raised an eyebrow, and said in my best frosty voice, "Really?" Bill chuckled and vanished the special effects. Well, inappropriate humor is our trademark, right? He invoked a beanbag chair, fell backward into it, and went boneless. I'm indebted to you, Neil, for reminding me how much we used to love these things. After a pause. So anyway, the carnage is just incredible. We lost 90% of our ships, and I don't know if we have enough busters and bombs left at this point to hold off a Girl Scout troop. But we've knocked out every piece of others' hardware in the system. Except Bellerophon, of course. And we've got drones doing full reconnaissance just in case. We've all seen the movies where everyone relaxes too soon. No thanks. We all sat silently for a few milliseconds. I called up a beer. Without saying anything, Bill and Neil did the same. We raised our glasses in a silent toast and each took a drink. But there was still that other nagging issue. Bill, we still have the others to deal with. We need some kind of definitive solution. Otherwise, the problem will just keep regrowing. Bill shook his head.
Problem taken care of.
Sorry, we've been so busy that I didn't get around to making an announcement, but I got the report from Daedalus and Icarus the other day. Their tau is up so high that it took almost a week for them to format the report and send it. Bill grinned. I launched a little experiment of my own back in 2225. Never said much about it because it was kind of a Hail Mary. I didn't want to raise false hopes, and I wanted to ensure we continued planning for a frontal assault. Anyway, about 10 days ago, GL-877 went Nova. There is nothing left in that system now, right out to the Oort cloud, confirmed by the monitor drones just before they expired. Neil and I looked at each other in shock.
We can do that?
Dude, Neil said. I stared at Bill. Someday some species is going to observe that explosion and wonder what the hell is wrong with their stellar models. We let the silence stretch for a few milliseconds, content with the moment. Then Bill continued.
Mario will be sending out Bobs to do sweeps of the outskirts of GL-877 and surrounding stars, and we'll implement patrols for a century or two in the stellar neighborhood, but barring any nests we might find, I think we're done with the others.
I lost my smile. So, we've just wiped out an entire species.
I hear you, Bill said, looking at his shoes. And philosophically, it's a heavy thought. But given what the others have done to us and to other species, I don't regret it one bit.
We nodded, once again silent. There's something else, I said, looking meaningfully at Bill. He closed his eyes slowly.
Oh, God. How many? And how?
The zap that grazed the earth. Cuba. About 150,000 people. Bill opened his mouth to say something and I cut him off. We checked. Bill nodded, silent. After a few milliseconds, he nodded to me.
My responsibility. I'll tell Will. You worry about the people you have on board.
Speaking of which,
Neil looked at me.
Should we make an announcement to our passengers?
Oh, yeah, guess so. Time to go home. We unloaded the humans in reverse order. Last in, first out. The first wave of transports had just left, and we faced a quandary. Is there any point in decanting the humans that are currently in stasis? We'd just be sending them back down to a planet that's barely habitable these days. I looked at Will and Bill, eyebrows raised. Will's eyes were haunted, and he was slow to respond when addressed.
I'll check with the UN reps who are awake, but my feeling is,
no,
there's no reason to. With them in stasis, existing supplies will stretch farther, and we can drop off our waking population in the best locations.
How long will they be in stasis?
Neil asked.
You mean before you leave, I presume?
Bill answered. With all the debris from the battle, plus what you brought in the Bellerophon, Will no longer has a shortage of raw material to worry about, and all the autofactories that have been constructed for the defense effort can now be turned to producing nothing but stasis pods. We can produce the last 6 million in less than a year.
Well, hell, I said. Let's do this.
72. Recovery. Bob. June 22, 33. Delta Eridani.
It had been a hard month. I'd occasionally tried to activate the village VR and observe, but couldn't stand it for more than a few moments at a time. I hadn't had much experience with death when I was alive. None of my close relatives had died, and the few distant cousins who passed away were little more than names on annual Christmas cards. Archimedes had been a friend, had been family. This would be what it was like to lose a parent or sibling. I wept a couple of times for what I must have put my parents and sisters through. The insult to the injury, though, was how little of a ripple it made in Camelot. Life went on. Even Buster and his family, after a day or two, went back to life as a routine. Archimedes had mattered. He'd made a huge difference to the lives of the people there, and I found it offensive somehow that he was so completely and so soon relegated to the past. In my more rational moments, I wondered what exactly I expected. Parades? A monument? A monument. Interesting idea. I'd long since taken a genetic sample from Archimedes, of course. The question of his DNA differences from the Deltan archetype was an ongoing topic of research. It took a few days to stabilize the sample using the techniques developed on Earth and, incidentally, used on my human brain. One more day, and the monolith on Eden's largest moon had an additional entry. I had a vague worry that I was going over the edge into some kind of obsession. Being an immortal, insane computer would be a very bad thing, with capital letters. Hoping to get some perspective, I pinged Marvin and received an invitation. I popped into his VR and looked around. Marvin was continuing his self-imposed task of replicating every environment in every book and movie we'd ever read or seen. It had become a contest between us, where I'd try to identify the scene with as few hints as possible. This one had me flummoxed, though. As near as I could tell, it was just a small town. I stood outside a small cafe, and I could see Marvin inside, grinning at me through the display window. I turned to survey the scene. Normal people doing normal things, normal businesses for the early 21st century, but horses and carriages instead of cars. I shrugged and walked into the cafe. I sat across from Marvin, and Jeeves placed a coffee in front of me. Jeeves is a waiter in a beanery now? I raised an eyebrow at him. Marvin grinned and shrugged. It's not relevant, in case you're wondering. I nodded and let a few milliseconds of silence pass. Then, leaning forward, I began to talk. Marvin, bless his cloned heart, listened without commenting, even when tears started to course down my cheeks. When I was done, I leaned back and wiped my face with a napkin. Jeez, Bob. A friend that you've known for almost 70 years just died. What were you expecting? To just shrug and move on? This is life, dude. The sucky part, anyway. We're not alive. Yeah, we are. We're not biological anymore, but we're still alive. We make friends. We grieve. We apparently still fall in love. Let it happen. Mourn. And don't get all bent out of shape when other people don't mourn as deeply. They have their own lives. I sat back and nodded. Marvin was right, of course. But something about this still bugged me. Suddenly, I had it. You know, Marvin, we kid Howard about his lifestyle choices, but at least he's evolving. I think my problem is I stuck myself back into a rut first chance I got, and I've been there for 70 years, still trying to be human. Still trying to deny reality. Marvin grinned at me. Say, you're pretty perceptive today. Nyuk, nyuk. Anyway, Archimedes' death provides a clean break and the emotional jolt to take advantage of it. I'm a post-human computerized starship, and maybe it's about time I started acting like it. I finished my coffee and stood up. Thanks for the talk, Marv. I'll be in touch. By the way, the town? Nantucket, right? Sterling? Marvin grinned and nodded. We still couldn't fool one another. I walked slowly through Camelot. More of an amble, really. I had no particular destination or goal in mind. I'd modified Charlie the android, changing the fur pattern, head shape, and height. Robert was gone, and this nondescript Deltan wouldn't be around long enough to make friends or engage in more than casual conversation. I wanted to have one last opportunity to experience Archimedes' world, to feel the life that he'd lived. This was my goodbye to Eden. I spent time touching things, watching children at play, listening to the give and take of village life. I walked past Buster's tent, careful not to loiter, enjoying the sight, sound, and odor of family. And when I had had my fill, I walked out of the village for the last time. 73. Moot. Bill, January 2258, Bobnet. I gave the usual blap with the air horn and waited for the standard well wishes to die down. This was the largest moot we'd ever held, by a considerable margin, even with about half of our bobs still just backups and half of the active ones still in cradles waiting for a ship to be built. I would have preferred to wait until everyone was active again, but a growing background of discontent in the Bobiverse had me worried. Best to get it out in the open. I looked at Thor, who seemed to be the de facto spokesman for what I was privately starting to think of as the dissidents. I didn't want to overstate it. It wasn't like we were going to start shooting at each other. After all, despite the differences of opinion, we were still all Bob at the core. Thor looked around, gauging the mood of the audience. Then he faced me.
Bill, it's really simple. For the last 100+ years, we've been essentially in the service of the humans. We all remember the first meeting with you, Riker, Mario, Milo, and Bob. We all remember each person's decision to explore, settle, and so on. But most of us have, one way or another, ended up spending most of our existences shepherding humans, guarding humans, transporting humans, and arguing with humans. It's tiring.
A growl of approval greeted this last statement. I looked around and realized that, to a greater or lesser extent, most of the Bobs present agreed. Even many of the earlier generation Bobs. I hear what you're saying, Thor. I've not been in that grind as much, because I've been in Epsilon Eridani the whole time, playing mad scientist. I'm a little perplexed, though. Are you calling for a vote on something? Thor grinned at me.
No. There's no rules as such in the Bobiverse. Everyone is free to do what they want. I think we're just trying to come to an understanding of the situation.
Garfield stepped forward.
Bill, remember that discussion we had about us being Homo Sidereia?
I mock glared at him.
Et tu, Garfield?
Not really. But I understand what Thor is saying, and I agree with a lot of it. We are Homo Sidereia now. We're something more than just people in software. Garfield looked around. How many here are still physically in cradles at the backup site or elsewhere? A couple dozen hands went up. Garfield turned back to me.
These guys, physically, are glowing blue cubes sitting in a space station in the Oort cloud outside Epsilon Eridani. But they can be anywhere that Bobnet reaches. They can inhabit a Manny on Vulcan or Romulus and go shopping, or fly a drone or a manta through the atmosphere of Odin. They can observe the Deltans, or help with settling the Pav, or visit any of the other human settlements. Or they could even take a remote-controlled heaven vessel to the stars, all without ever leaving Epsilon Eridani.
Thor took up the recitation. Marcus got flying cities working on Poseidon and has completely altered their society. Howard and Bridget have built floating cities in the upper atmosphere of Big Top, and they live there full-time, in android form, with a family of their own. Marcus has built dolphin-like androids to explore Poseidon underwater. Luke and Marvin are planning an expedition to go looking for Bender. Henry Roberts is trying to sail every large body of water on every planet of human space. Bridget is trying to catalog every species of life within her reach and is arranging expeditions to explore icy moons and planets. Daedalus and Icarus are hightailing it for the center of the galaxy. Thor swept his hand to take in the crowd. And we want to do all those things. But instead, we're playing taxi, or construction yard, or security patrol, or long-haul service, and we're a little tired of being robotic servants to the human race. I nodded and looked down for a moment, gathering my thoughts. I looked up and swept the crowd with my gaze. I by no means want to minimize your feelings on this. I do, however, think there's a certain amount of burnout involved here. This has been a total crapper of a couple of decades. Laughs from the crowd showed that I'd scored. And I think you'll feel a little less, militant about it after a chance to rest. Thor looked at me, not conceding anything with his expression.
Maybe. And let's face it, Bill, we're not asking for or threatening anything irreversible or irrevocable. We just want the humans and maybe the elder Bobs to understand and accept that the species of Bob is not available as their collective workhorse. If individual Bobs want to help out, fine. But if the humans get themselves into another mess like the last one, I don't think we're going to all jump in and throw ourselves under the bus for them.
Will you require a treaty?
Thor laughed. Nothing that formal, Bill. Just the statement and the understanding. I looked around at the Bobs in the room. It seemed to be a majority opinion from the expressions.
Well, what the hell?
All right, Thor. I'll put together a statement, get some input on it, then distribute it to the colonies. And some of them, Garfield said, smiling, will go ballistic.
Oh, depend on it.
74. PAV announcement. Jacques, April 2257, HIP 84051. The cargo doors opened and I stepped out. Not surprisingly, a squad of PAV militia awaited me, weapons held at ready. I sighed and shook my head. It was entirely possible that the PAV military would never warm to the Bobs. I couldn't really blame them, of course. Every interaction reminded them of the technological gulf between us, and of their complete helplessness if we ever started making demands. Not a comfortable situation for a military mind. I walked up to the group, being careful not to appear aggressive. They probably wouldn't haul off and shoot me, just because, but why take chances? The squad leader took a half step forward and I addressed him. Hasjiar is expecting me. The sergeant, or whatever equivalent, looked like he wanted to frisk me. Or maybe handcuff me, or just give me a good beating. But I was obviously not carrying anything of a technical nature, so he settled for glaring at me and showing his teeth for a moment. I gave him a close-lipped smile in return and looked meaningfully in the direction of Hasjiar's house. This whole performance could have gone on for a few more minutes if Hasjiar hadn't picked that moment to walk out onto her porch. She made a gesture to the soldiers and they motioned to me with their weapons. I settled into a chair, bobbed my head to Hasjiar, and waited for her to speak.
You said you had news? Presumably it is about the others?
Yes, I replied. I wanted to deliver this news in person. The battle is over. We've won. Although, barely. Hasjiar nodded and stared at the horizon for a few moments.
This is good, of course. But will they not just regroup and return? For how long will we be safe?
There will be no return, Hasjiar. We wiped them out. I looked down for a moment, then met her eyes. It wasn't something we did casually. But they have obliterated so many sentients and showed no interest in changing their behavior. The soldiers exchanged glances. If they were concerned about the gulf between us before, this wouldn't have helped. I spared them a quick look, then continued. We will continue to watch for them, but it's most likely that there are none left.
I don't understand your species, Jacques.
Hasjiar paused, looking at me.
You have all this power, yet you seem reluctant to use it. You are so rich that you don't even need money, yet you seem to have so little.
I looked up at the ceiling for a moment. She was, perhaps without realizing it, hitting very close to home with some of her comments. Hasjiar, we, all the Bobs, I mean, don't have any desire for power over others. Quite the opposite, in fact. We just want to be able to do our own thing. And we may finally be at the point where we can realize that desire. I gestured to the soldiers. You have power, in the ways that matter. You're able to keep yourselves safe here. We'll make sure nothing gets out of control up there. I gestured to the sky. Beyond that, unless you specifically need us for something, we'll leave you alone. I think, as a group, the Bobs have finally figured out our place in the cosmos, so we're going to be stepping back. Hasjiar gazed at the soldiers for a moment, then smiled at me.
Some of us, I think, will be happy to hear that. I am not so sure. In any case, we will live.
She stood.
Thank you, Jacques, for the news. I will inform the council.
I stood and gave her the PAV head bob, then walked to the cargo drone. I stepped in and turned for a last look. As the doors were closing, I saw Hasjiar give me the Vulcan salute. I popped into PRP. The PAV reclamation project had a dedicated VR, hosted in Bill's mood station. I looked around the room. A half dozen Bobs watched video windows or operated drones on the planet's surface. Ferb stood at the edge of the room watching the activity.
Hey, Ferb. I walked over to him. How's it going?
Slow but steady, Jacques. We've been able to produce at least a few of everything that we have samples for. Genetic diversity may be an issue for a while, but we should be able to bring back about 75% of the planet's ecosystems, eventually.
I nodded, watching a few of the video windows. And the other thing?
Ferb motioned toward a whiteboard with a number of items listed. We've found some good candidate planetoids in nearby systems. Bill's asteroid movers will handle them easily.
I nodded, satisfied. So eventually we'll be able to offer the PAV their home system back, with a supply of metals.
Maybe a few decades yet, buddy, but yeah, that'll be good.
We watched the activity in the room, enjoying the moment.
One less thing to feel guilty about.
75. Rebuilding. Herschel, January 2259, Seoul. Departure day. Two little words, but such a big meaning. Today would put humanity officially out of the endangered species category. Today, we would leave the Earth looking a lot like a snowball to its own devices for a few millennia. Hopefully the planet would recover. If so, we had the genetic material to rebuild at least some of the ecosystems. With the extinction of the others, Gamma Pavonis had become a viable colonization target. Several colony ships had returned to Earth since the Battle of Seoul, and were now on their way with a load of humanity to settle there. And we now had enough stasis pods in the Bellerophon for the balance of the human race. Today, the remaining Earthlings were leaving for 82 Eridani, all snugged away in our cargo bays. By the time they arrived, Mac and the local crew would have built farm donuts and colony locations for them. Inevitably, some of the humans wouldn't like the decisions. Tough. The debris from the Battle of Terra, at least that portion of it that hadn't already gone down to Earth in meteor showers, was all gathered at the Earth-Moon L5 point. Auto factories were still going full bore to build new vessels for all the bobs that had been destroyed in the battle. Bill's off-site facility was showing its worth. Only a few differentials had failed, and in those cases the bobs were simply restored with the last few minutes missing. There still existed a general feeling amongst the bobs that being restored wasn't quite personal immortality, but most agreed that it sure beat the alternative. I decided I'd leave that particular philosophical debate until it became relevant. I looked over at Neil.
Ready for departure, number one?
Oh, bite me, and for the record, your Picard is terrible.
Yeah, but we're still in charge of this tub. Not bad for pond scum, eh? Neil grinned.
Could do worse.
Singing the accountancy shanty at the top of our lungs, we set course for 82 Eridani.
76. Pilgrimage. Bob. October 2263. Earth. Full circle. A couple hundred meters or so, straight down, a city named Las Vegas had once stood. Lost Wages, Sin City, the place where my first life ended. I turned slowly to survey the landscape, ice scape, I guess. The earth was now in full snowball mode. Snow, once fallen, was not melting, and glaciers were closing in on the equator. Today was a beautiful bluebird day. The sun shone down on the ice, leaving the world awash in light. If I'd still been biological, I'd be snowblind by now. I had arranged with the current Bob in residence, a 10th generation named Harvey, to have an android printed up from Howard's most recent published set of plans. I could have done this visit remotely from Delta Eridani, or from anywhere in range of BobNet, really, but I wanted to actually come to Earth, to make the pilgrimage physically as well as emotionally. The Heaven 1B was currently in geosynchronous orbit, 35,000 kilometers straight overhead. I raised my face into the breeze and closed my eyes. The air ruffled my hair and whistled thinly against my ears. Heads-up readings, visible even on the inside of my eyelids, indicated a balmy minus 30 Celsius. Well within operating range for current android tech. The Earth was definitely done for, though.
For a few millennia, anyway. There was some argument at Moot's about whether we should set up space mirrors to reheat the planet, or just let things run their course. Bob's had been working, the last couple of decades, to make sure that every possible living thing was represented in the genetic banks. These days, we didn't even take samples. We simply grabbed a scan at the subatomic level. Bill had been busy in his mad science lab in Epsilon Eridani. It wasn't quite Star Trek-level replicator technology, but it was certainly getting damned close. Within a few more years, Bill expected to be able to rebuild plants and animals from nothing more than the scans. Pretty cool. I looked down once more in the direction of Las Vegas and thought back to that last day as a human being. I remembered the conversation with my mother and Andrea and felt a deep and abiding regret at not having had one last conversation with my father and with Elena. There was that last meal with my employees who, I now realized, were possibly my best friends on the planet at the time. Their lives were now less than a footnote in history, as gone, as utterly forgotten as any random individual from the Middle Ages. No longer even a ripple in time, except to the extent that I could keep their memories alive. I sighed to myself. It seemed sometimes that life was nothing more than the accumulation of emotional baggage, memories, regrets, and lost opportunities. I looked up as I detected the faint susurrus of an approaching craft. Odd, since I hadn't called my cargo drone to pick me up. I turned and watched as a drone came to rest on the ice, 50 feet away. There was a pause, then the cargo doors opened and two androids walked out. I queried metadata. Bill! Will! Grinning, I hurried over to meet them halfway. Hey, Bob. When Harvey told us what you were planning, we asked him to make a couple of extra. Are you guys in system? Bill shook his head. No, you're the one on the pilgrimage. I'm fine with doing this from Ragnarok. I nodded, then looked at Will. On my way to 82 Eridani. I'm keeping the Tau down so I can stay on top of things. He grinned at me. Once a control freak? I laughed. How are things going at 82 Eridani? Going great, Will replied. They've got atmospheric pressure up to something reasonable on Valhalla. When the people on the Bellerophon arrive, they'll have three viable worlds to choose from. The colonies that are already there will complain about blow-ins, of course. Will turned and looked out across the ice fields. Humanity is well distributed now. It's beginning to look like they'll probably survive their own stupidity after all. After a moment of comfortable silence, Bill asked, So, what will you do now, Bob? I looked at my two friends, then looked up at the sky. Going out, I think. The new Bobs are right. We're Homo Sidereia. And I'm tired of always finding myself committed to something. It's time to cut all ties. Just point the bow and turn on the drive. See what's out there. You'll keep in touch? Of course. I smiled at Bill. I'll stop and build stations, so I stay connected to BobNet. Someday, maybe, the net will stretch from one end of the galaxy to the other. And we'll probably still be around, Will said. As you say, we've got forever. I nodded, then turned toward the cargo drone. You guys mind taking my android to storage? I'm going to travel light, I think. Bill nodded. No problem. We walked back to the drone and climbed in. I turned to my two oldest friends, shook their hands, and switched off. And 35,000 kilometers above, I turned on the surge drive and headed out to the stars.
This has been an Audible Studios production of All These Worlds, Bobaverse Book 3. Written by Dennis E. Taylor. Performed by Ray Porter. Executive producers Steve Feldberg and Mike Charzik. Producer Neil Basic. Copyright 2017 by Dennis E. Taylor. Sound recording copyright 2017 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.